Time for the news with VG Alice. Good afternoon, VG.
Good afternoon, Petrov. The European Union is to hold an emergency meeting this afternoon to discuss President Trump's threat of extra trade tariffs on 8 European countries, including the UK. Mr. Trump said the 10% tariffs would come into effect from February unless he's allowed to buy Greenland from Denmark. Sir Keir Starmer's condemned the threat as completely wrong. The cabinet minister, Lisa Nandy, told Sunday with Laura Kunzberg that she expects the US to negotiate.
We saw that with the tariffs. We've also seen it in other areas where, for example, on film tariffs, there was a conversation. It was clear that that would not be in British interests, but also not in US interests as well.
So
that's
believe
a conversation
him?
That we've been able to continue to have.
So you think he'll chicken out?
Well, I don't think he'll chicken out. I think this is actually a really serious issue, and I think it deserves a far more adult debate than us threatening the United States and the United States threatening us.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is meeting his cabinet to discuss President Trump's appointments to panels in the Gaza peace process. Israel says it's unhappy it was not consulted about the makeup of one of the new bodies, the Gaza Executive Board. Palestinians have also been critical of the appointments because none of their representatives are included. 4,500 properties in the Maidstone area of Kent are without water or have intermittent supplies this morning because of an electrical fault at a treatment works. It's the latest problem to affect Southeast Water customers after days of disruption early this week. The supplier says it expects today's issues to be resolved by the afternoon. A teenage boy is in a critical condition after a suspected shark attack at a beach in Sydney, Australia. The boy, who's believed to be aged around 13, was rescued from Shark Beach with serious leg injuries and taken to a children's hospital. Britain's Cameron Norrie is through to the second round of the men's draw at the Australian Open after a dramatic 5-set win over the French player Benjamin Bonzi. He'll face the American player Emilio Nava in the second round at Melbourne Park. And in the past hour, Venus Williams, who was looking for her first major win in almost 5 years, has been knocked out by Olga Danilovic. The weather, there'll be sunny spells across Northern Ireland, northern parts of Scotland and southeast England this afternoon, but it will be cloudy with outbreaks of rain across central parts of the UK. Highs of 8 degrees Celsius in Belfast and 11 in London. BBC News at 12:02. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Actor and presenter Peter Purvis has been involved in two of television's longest-running and most loved institutions. Between 1965 and 1966, he played Stephen Taylor, space and time-travelling companion to the first ever Doctor Who, William Hartnell. And for 10.5 years, from 1967 to 1978, alongside John Noakes, Valerie Singleton and Leslie Judd, he presented Blue Peter, entertaining the nation's children with twice-weekly tea-time doses of demonstrations in everything from competitive swimming and traditional dance to chimney sweeping and rock climbing, as well as travel to exotic locations around the world. A dog lover, Peter has also presented television coverage of the dog show Crufts for many years. You've always loved music, Peter, I know, and grew up in a musical house, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But you've said that your appreciation of classical music didn't really develop until later in life, when punk ruined the musical scene. I quote, what did you mean by that?
I used to listen to a lot of rock music, a lot of very good rock bands. I quite like country rock, but punk came in and destroyed the music scene for me immediately. And the love of good tunes came back to me, and I started listening to Mozart. I went to a concert, actually, Jane Glover conducting the clarinet concerto, Mozart. And it was absolutely stunning. It remains one of my favourite pieces of music of all time. And that brought it... I started listening. So I would listen to Radio 3 in the car. I've got classical music on. I don't listen to pop music of any kind. I'm totally out of touch with it.
Well, shall we begin with the piece that triggered your love of classical music? That is the Mozart Clarinet Concerto. And indeed, we have Jane Glover conducting the London Mozart Players and the soloist is Andrew Mariner.
It's a glorious instrument,
yes.
The clarinet. I love it. When I was a much younger man, when I was in repertory in the theatre in Barrow and Furness, some friends of mine played in a jazz band, and I always liked, first of all, the look of the clarinet and also the way that my friend Bob Biggins played it. Bits of fantasy that come out of it. It's absolutely lovely.
Peter Purvis, you were born in Preston in 1939 and grew up in Blackpool, where your parents ran a hotel, I think. You
yes.
had a happy childhood, didn't you? Quite a lot of music around.
There was a lot of music around. My father, as a boy soprano, he'd won the Blackpool Music Festival 3 years running. He didn't enter the fourth year because he thought his voice would have broken, and it hadn't. And he always said, I'd have won it as well.
And I think your grandmother was a soprano.
She was very musical. She played the piano well. And her husband was the conductor of the choir at New Longton, which was the village near Preston where they lived. He would also present Gilbert and Sullivan. I saw my first major Gilbert and Sullivan production at the Opera House in Blackpool and was very impressed with it. Nice music I grew up with, and I had a reasonable voice myself. I was a soloist at school.
Was that the Arnold School in Blackpool?
Arnold School, which no longer exists. It was a minor public school.
You were a soloist at the school carol service, where one of your friends was a good pianist. And I think you remember him in particular playing Schubert.
Yes, he was called David Johnson, and he was a rather excellent pianist. When we had the school speech day every year, which was done in Blackpool at the Palace Theatre, which no longer exists, David played as the main entertainment of the piece. Wonderful pianist. He became a music teacher. He was a very nice lad. He was a very good friend. absolutely gorgeous. You know, is it Vokes sitting by the river? I used to go up into the Lake District and swim in a pool under a bridge, little village called Ulfa on the Duddon Valley. It was a very deep pool there and some lovely little stepping stones which caused the water to ripple over it. It's Schubert through and through. When I went there, I heard his music every time.
Maria João Pires played Schubert's Impromptu in G-flat major, number 3. Aged 9, Peter Purvis, your parents moved to Derbyshire, and rather than move you to a new school, you became a boarder, I think, at the Arnold School.
That's right.
You played quite a lot of sports, which probably stood you in good stead when you came to work on Blue Peter. But academically, did you do well?
No, I was not a great academic. Basically because I didn't work at it. I'm quite good at things if I'm prepared to work at them. We did a play every year, and the first year we did the Pied Piper of Hamelin. I was 9 and I was the Pied Piper. It's always nice to play the leading role. And I played Robin Hood in Robin Hood in the third year. I knew, because I lived in Blackpool and I had seen so much theatre, I'd seen ice shows, I'd seen variety, I'd seen music hall, I'd seen opera, I'd seen drama, I've seen the pier shows. I used to go and watch one every Saturday morning on South Pier. Uncle Peter Webster's show, especially for kids. Fantastic. So I knew what I wanted to do. From the age of 9, I wanted to be an actor. There was never any question. So I didn't work. Consequently, I got one advanced level subject, and that was it, maths. I failed my others and never went to university. But because of that, I went to Teachers College near Stoke-on-Trent, where, again, I didn't do any work. I sang lead singer with a skiffle group that we had at college. I was president of the Dramatic Society. I was quite busy with all that all the time. Consequently, I didn't do any work there either.
It was a junior school, as you said, that you first got this acting bug. But the school elocution teacher didn't take your acting ambitions terribly seriously.
No, this was by the time I was about 13 or 14, and in one class, the elocution teacher, which was trying to get rid of our Blackpool accents, and he managed more or less with me. I've still got flat A's, which say you're coming from the north. But he was asking, what are you planning to do when you leave school? What do you think you might do? And I just said, I want to be an actor. And he laughed at me. And I thought, well, I'll show you. In fact, he had to cast me in one of the Shakespearean excerpts that we did at the speech day. And I played Peter Quince in a small segment we did with the Mechanicals from A Midsummer Night's Dream. But I was determined after that. There was never any question.
Well, you mentioned Shakespeare, which is appropriate because that's where we're going in a moment, courtesy of Mendelssohn. But when did you first encounter Shakespeare in the theatre?
I have seen quite a lot of Shakespeare. I love the comedies, Midsummer Night's Dream. I saw at Stratford, I think I was 21. It had a magnificent cast. It had Judi Dench playing Titania, Ian Richardson playing Oberon, Diana Rigg, mostly unheard of at that time, absolutely stellar. And I thought it was absolutely magical.
Does Mendelssohn's music for you capture the essence of the Midsummer Night's Dream?
Absolutely it does. The opening part of the overture, you are in the forest. The fairies, the creatures, they are all there. You feel them, you hear them. The atmosphere draws you in the most glorious way.
Thank you. Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream Overture, Edward Gardner conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3 with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest today, the television presenter Peter Purvis. For your final school year, Peter, I think you transferred to Barrow Grammar School in Barrow-in-Furness, where your parents now lived. In Barrow, you auditioned for the repertory company at the local theatre. Did that work out happily?
Yes, it turned out very well. I was 18 in 1957. I literally just contacted the theatre and asked to speak to the artistic director, Donald Sartain. And in my school holidays, he cast me in a couple of plays. They paid me £5 a week. I absolutely loved it. After that, I went to Teachers College for 2 years. I then taught for a year, just to keep my dad happy, I think. And after a year, I just gave it up. Stop, no. My mother, who was still living in Barrow, contacted Donald, and he sent me a telegram saying, if you want it, there's a job for you here. Well, I mean, that was gold. And I went back to Barrow-in-Furness, and I joined the Renaissance Theatre Company. I did a frightening number of plays, because 2 years, one play a week, a little bit off for the summer, a couple of weeks holiday. We did, I think, 96 plays in 2 years. And that was the best training you could ever get. Some parts suited you, some parts didn't, and some parts you were absolutely dreadful in. But that was just the way it would be. We're a group of players who played a different play every week. And we did everything from Shakespeare to comedy dell'arte to Whitehall farces. It's the hardest work, the most fun, the worst paid work that I've ever done. I met one of my best friends there. I talked about the jazz band earlier and the clarinetist, but my best friend was the trumpeter who formed the band, a lovely guy called Les Bull. There was a traditional jazz band, very good one, called the Furness Jazz College 7. When I was in London, I went and listened to a lot of jazz at 100 Oxford Street, which was Humphrey Littleton's club originally. But let me go back. Before I moved to Barrow in Blackpool, when I was 15, I think, I went to the Grand Theatre and saw Count Basie. My first real introduction to big bands. So I'd listened to a lot of them on record, my dad's dance music and stuff like that. So it was filtering through. Count Basie Band was at that time absolutely worldwide famous, magnificent. I mean, he was such a cool pianist, and his arrangements were wonderful. They have a singer in the band called Joe Williams. And he just came up to the mic on his introduction. He got a nice round of applause when he came in, nothing pretentious about him at all. Just walked gently to the centre of the stage, stood at the mic, the band started to play, and he sang. And he never moved. There was no gyrating, there was no nothing. He just stood, his hands calm by his side, and just sang. His voice was fantastic. He did three numbers. Tumultuous applause, left the stage, and that's all we saw of him. I was in New York in 1972, wandering through Soho one evening, and there was a small bar, and outside it said, Joe Williams. And I went in, and it was Joe, and he was singing. And afterwards, I went up to him, and I said, excuse me, Joe, I said, I hope you don't mind me coming and talking to you. I just wanted to say, about almost 20 years ago, I saw you in Blackpool. And I just wanted to say how wonderful an experience it was for me. And he said, oh, that's really very kind of you. Thank you. He said, Blackpool? He said, I married a Blackpool girl.
Okay, you win, I'm in love with you. Well, all right, okay, you win, baby, what can I do? I'll do anything you say, it's just got to be that way. Well, all right, okay, you win, I'm in love with you. Well, all right,
okay, you win. Baby, what can I do? Anything you say I'll do, as long as it's me and you. But the first thing in the morning, you got to wake me with a kiss. You got to make up for all the loving you have made me miss. All right, well, okay, you win. I'm in love with you. Well, all right, well, okay, you win. Baby, what can I do? Anything you do, I'll say. It's just got to be that way. Hard to do. Well, all right, well, okay, you win. What are you waiting for? Well, all right, okay, you win. Baby, one thing more. If I'm gonna be your man, pretty baby, let me take your hand. Well, all right, okay.
I like that.
It's wonderfully raunchy. Joe Williams with Count Basie and his orchestra in All Right, OK, You Win, I'm in Love with You, on the 1955 album Count Basie Swings, Joe Williams Sings. Talking about being all right, you win. I think you met your first wife in Rep in Barrow in Furness, Gilly, a fellow actor.
That's right, yes, yes. She was a member of the company. And we got married in 1963 and moved down to London to try and earn a living there. My first job was at the Palladium in the chorus. We were the Derek Taverner Singers in a show called Man in the Moon with Charlie Drake. It was a dreadful show, I can't tell you, absolutely awful. But I was in the chorus and I was a top tenor. The show, which was supposed to run a year, it was so bad it came off after 3 months.
You auditioned for the BBC and started getting small television roles.
My first one was Zed Cars, which was a police show set in the north of England, and Gideon's Way, Court Martial. And then I was cast as the leading man in a play called The Girl in the Picture. I was a Blackpool beach photographer. Now, what could have been a more tailor-made part for me than that? It was on Thames Television on a Sunday night in a series called Armchair Theatre and went down very well. I then went along to do an audition for Doctor Who. The director had heard that I was in the chorus at the Palladium and therefore I could probably move quite well because these characters were giant insects. It was called The Web of Fear, the serial. And when I arrived at the BBC and went into the office, the previous day, the Sunday, my Armchair Theatre had been shown. And I walked in, the director recognised me, said, I watched your play last night, Peter. And he was very complimentary about my performance. And he said, well, I'm not going to offer you one of these, but it was heartbreaking for me. I wanted a job because money was running out. You know, you needed work, actors do. He said, I'm not going to give you one of these parts. He said, I will think of you when I have a decent part for you to play, but this, it's not worthy of you. You know, that's the sort of thing that directors say to actors when they don't have anything for them.
So just for a while before fortune struck, you were living in a land of hope, really, and it's Elgar we're going to next.
Yes. Elgar has always been Well, he does inspire you, doesn't he? I love Elgar's music. I could have chosen any number of his works that would have fitted just as well. I love the fact that we still get Pomp and Circumstance played at the end of the proms every year. I think it's uplifting, wonderful in every way. I love it. But the piece that I've chosen, which I do think is probably my favourite, and I had to have an Elgar piece in here somewhere, and that's from the Enigma Variations, which I truly love, and particularly Nimrod. So beautifully lyrical, and I just shut my eyes and love it.
like a lot of great pieces which have become very popular, it has a kind of yearning quality too.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Makes you feel warm all over.
Nimrod from the Enigma Variations by Elgar. Andrew Davis was conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Well, as I said, Peter, you were living for a while in a land of hope for something really important to come up, and you did actually achieve hope and glory when you were offered a part in Doctor Who.
Well, yes, I'd taken it with a pinch of salt that Richard Martin, the director, just said, I'll think of you. Well, I thought, but he did think of me. He cast me as an American hillbilly on holiday in New York on top of the Empire State Building for a sort of 5-6 minute scene in Doctor Who with the Doctor and his companions and with the Daleks, who also followed on in another time machine in pursuit. And my idiot character thought that they were making a film and I was looking for all the technology and all that. Immediately after we finished the recording of that, I was invited to have a drink by Dennis Spooner, the story editor, and Verity Lambert, the producer, in Studio 3, which was the pub across the road from Riverside Studios, where we were recording. And literally, you could have knocked me over the feather because they said, I don't know if you know, but Jacqueline Hill and William Russell, who, of course, were the Doctor's original companions, William Russell and Jacqueline Hill, are leaving in 3 weeks. Would you be interested in taking over? And 3 weeks later, in the same serial, The Chase, episode 6, because that one that I'd been in was episode 3, I was fully in there as Stephen Taylor's space pilot, and I did 46 episodes in total.
You were working with the very first Doctor Who, William Hartnell. He has a reputation now of being very dedicated to the programme, but he could be irascible and difficult, and some say he was racist and homophobic. How did you find him? Was he a good colleague?
He was a brilliant colleague. Well, actually, I'm indebted to him too, because he was very concerned that Jackie and Russ were leaving. Maureen O'Brien, who was the other companion eventually with me, she knew that Bill was worried about this. She watched me in rehearsal and watched how I got on with Bill, and I got on with him very well. He liked me and he treated me extremely generously. He let me do my silly jokes, and that no one said don't do them, so that's what went out on screen. And Maureen said to Bill on the Wednesday of that first week, Bill, I know you're worried about Jackie and Russ, but what about this boy? And Bill went to Verity Lambert and said, watch him in the recording. I didn't know that. So Bill was responsible for me getting the part. I did see him occasionally in a strop, but never with me, never with Maureen. And we both loved working with him. He was good fun. It was difficult sometimes because he was losing the capacity to learn and remember the lines. So we'd often find ourselves on set standing around hoping that Bill would get back on script and give us the right cue, which eventually he got somewhere near. We could always dig him out a little bit, but we were recording as live, no editing. So if he made a mistake, that's what went out on air. And so it was, you know, it could be a little bit desperate.
On your time on that programme, I mean, you battled Daleks and Vikings, visited ancient Troy, 16th century France, a planet ruled by Amazonian women, and the Wild West, where you got to display your talents actually for comedy and music.
The music one, people would dispute. I did get a chance to sing during the show in The Gunfighters. I'm dressed rather like Roy Rogers. I managed to trip over my spurs. I managed to drop my gun when I was trying to show off how you do all that. The Clanton brothers make me sing at gunpoint at the OK Corral. It was not in my key. It wasn't really comfortable singing, and so I found it a bit difficult. However, I think it was funny. I've watched it, and I do think it's amusing.
Doctor Who had only been going a year and a half by that point. Could you have imagined that the programme was destined to still be running over 60 years later?
No, none of us could. It's just grown from strength to strength. Now it's making it huge studios out in Cardiff. It's a magnificent setup there, quite amazing. I'm not 100% convinced that it's better than it used to be.
Were you very disappointed in 1966 when a new producer came on board and your contract wasn't renewed?
I was extremely disappointed. I had no intention. I wouldn't have left, and Bill Hartnell didn't want me to leave.
Fortunately, your association with Doctor Who has continued, as we'll hear later. But next, Louis Armstrong.
I loved my traditional jazz, but there was nothing like Louis Armstrong. I'd listened to all his records, all his early ones. I got a chance to see him at the Free Trade Hall in Manchester when he played pretty late in his career. Our seats were on the stage, front row behind the band. He sang a lot. The band played wonderfully, but he did play a few wonderful bits on the trumpet. Obviously, he didn't have the wind anymore, but I tell you, any one note that he played was worth the price of the ticket. It was sensational to hear that trumpet played perfectly by him.
Thank you.
What do you think of them apples?
Yeah, they were pretty amazing. Louis Armstrong and his All-Stars, live at Symphony Hall, Boston, in 1947. And that was the
Mahogany Hall Stomp.
Mahogany Hall Stomp, thank you very much. Peter Purvis, following Doctor Who, things were not looking too good on the acting side. You even got dumped by your agent. But their parting shot was to pass on a message from BBC's Blue Peter programme to go for a meeting at Television Centre with the editor Biddy Baxter. This obviously went well, because you started work as a presenter on the programme in November 1967. Many listeners will be familiar with Blue Peter, still going strong today. But for those who aren't, how would you describe the programme and what it sets out to do?
Blue Peter was a magazine programme. It was designed for children aged 7s to 12s, and whoever watched with those children would perhaps find it not unpleasant. The aim was not to educate, it was to entertain, but it was to be truthful and was to be honest. It was also to allow children to experience things that they might not otherwise be able to experience. They experienced things through us, through the presenters. They also, and a very clever idea I think it was by editor Biddy Baxter, weren't allowed in high-rise flats and so on to keep pets. So we had surrogate pets in the studio that became virtually the pets of the audience. I had one of them when I joined the programme. Petra the dog was already part of the programme, and she didn't like the studio much, and Biddy Baxter thought it would probably make the dog happier if I looked after her. She became my dog. I took her home, I took her to the vets, I fed her, I walked her, I sometimes took her filming with me, and I brought her to the studio twice a week. That was my first real introduction to dogs, so I experienced something very new with that. And I got a really good interest in dogs through Blue Peter.
Apart from quadrupeds like Petra, there were two well-established duopeds, weren't they, in John Noakes and Valerie Singleton. Did you fit in with them well?
Oh, we had a great time. We were a very good team working. I absolutely adored John, got on with him so well. In the end, I always knew what he was going to do before he did it. You know, he was always looking for a gag. If he could make a joke of something, he would. And Valerie, yes, I mean, we were all very good friends. And Leslie Judd, who followed on from Valerie. So in a 12-year period, there were only four presenters. So that gelled the show together. And anyone over the age of about 45 now watched when we were there.
You had to be able to do almost anything, or at least have a try. Skiing, chimney sweeping, water polo, rock climbing, stunt driving, the Royal Tournament. And lots of it was a bit dangerous. For you, what were the most hair-raising things you had to do?
The Forth Road Bridge wasn't particularly terrifying, but I'm very proud of it. The bridge inspector has to inspect the bridge. This is not the railway bridge. I filmed on that as well, by the way. But the Forth Road Bridge is a suspension bridge. So if you imagine the cable goes up to one side, swings across the middle, up again, and then down the other side. Each fortnight, he walks the whole cable. I went with him. There's nothing to tie on to. And it was a bit frightening. You start going up the cable and it gradually gets steeper. But you get to a point where you can't see the roadway underneath. All you can see is the sea. And it's all down to Harry Lauder singing, "Keep right on to the end of the road." Fabulous. It's a wonderful bit of film. So that was a bit hairy. But as I say, I'm very proud of it.
Well, things didn't always go to plan. One infamous incident that many listeners will remember is the visit to the Blue Peter studio of Lulu the baby elephant.
Yes. anyone who hasn't seen it, it's one of those clips. Well, you couldn't write it. We were going to Sri Lanka. And Biddy Baxter thought it was a good idea that we had an elephant in the studio. So we brought a baby elephant from Chessington Zoo. And Lulu the elephant with a keeper. There's a big chain round the elephant's neck, and he holds on to that like a dog's lead. And in his other hand, he's got a rather bulbous-ended stick. And he said, "Come on, Lulu," and Lulu stands still. So he gently, and I mean gently, taps the elephant just above the on the forehead, and Lulu followed him wherever. Well, we did the rehearsal. Fine. And Biddy Baxter said, when we actually do this, do you think you could do it without the stick? And so he did it without the stick, and the result was sort of moderate chaos, really. The elephant went wherever it wanted. He tried to lead it off. It came charging back. It liked us because we'd given it some bread and some water. It had already weed and defecated on the studio floor, so the floor was very slippery because of where it had weed. And the keeper, trying to hold the elephant back as it charged through us on his final run, slipped, whoops, and was dragged out. It's hysterical. We were laughing our heads off as well. It was impossible not to. The cameras were almost shaking with the camera laughing. It was a classic moment.
Working with children and animals. Billy Baxter died last year, aged 92. She was editor of Blue Peter for a phenomenal 23 years. How would you rank her achievement?
Oh, I think Blue Peter was a success because of her. I mean, I didn't get on eye to eye with her all the time, but she was an amazing editor. She had a massive reputation at the BBC of being very, very demanding. But she knew what she wanted, and that's what she got. You know, all the Doctor Who tapes that I did, they were all wiped, as they did, with 2-inch tape, because it's difficult to store. So out of my 46 episodes, only 17 exist. Every episode of every show recorded on 2-inch tape that Billy Baxter was in charge of is still in the archive.
Well, more music now. It's Tchaikovsky, the Capriccio Italien.
I love this piece. It's uplifting in every way to the listener, but it's about the musicians enjoying playing it. And this, the Capriccio Italien, Tchaikovsky I adore. I love all his ballet music. It's absolutely wonderful. This piece, you can hear the orchestra enjoying it. Every instrument has its day, and you can almost see the musician smiling as they play it, and you know the conductor is having the time of his life.
Well, the conductor on that occasion was Vasily Petrenko and the orchestra of the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, and we heard the conclusion of Tchaikovsky's Capriccio Italien. This is BBC Radio 3, and you're listening to Private Passions with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest today, the actor and presenter Peter Purvis. For details of all Peter's music and to explore hundreds of other episodes with guests like Miranda Hart and Terry Gilliam, head to BBC Sounds. Peter, in 1978, you decided to leave Blue Peter after 10.5 years. Was that another sad moment or quite a natural one?
I came back from a holiday and I thought, I'm not sure I want to do another year of this. I think I ought to move on. It was really a question of thinking, well, the future, I can't do this for the rest of my life. At that time, I was nearly 40. And I thought, I've got to move on. I've got to try and see what else there is out there. When I left, Edward Barnes, who by then was head of children's programmes, and he'd been the assistant editor, producer of Blue Peter, very kindly moved me on to other shows. He gave me a series called Stopwatch, which was a new sports programme which came out of Manchester. Another series called We're Going Places, which was Holiday Ideas, which I did with Sue Cook. Kickstart and Junior Kickstart, which is a motorbike trial show. I also picked up all the BBC's darts coverage. So, I mean, it was darts was just becoming big. And I played darts in the BBC club, and actually I was playing quite well. Tony Green, who was one of the commentators and a professional darts player, I played him several times, beat him a few times. Because I played darts, Tony Green mentioned me to the head of sport in Manchester, and they asked me to do it. So I did something like 400 shows for them. You know, we did all the world championships and everything. So, yeah, I was a very busy man. I'd also picked up Croft's Dog Show. So I was kept busy for a few years.
Crafts must have been particularly rewarding for you because you'd come to love dogs.
Absolutely,
you?
Yes. Just before I left Blue Peter in 1976, I was asked to do a one-off show for Crafts. I took 6 children to Crafts. They had bits of paper which said, find the dog with the waggiest tail, find the biggest dog, find the smallest dog, find all the sort of silly things like that. And because of that, when I left Blue Peter, the first year they asked me to introduce the new sport of agility to Crofts. The following year, I then did all the obedience championships and we had then added agility and flyball to that. I was then the full-time presenter of the main show. In total, I did 41 years on Crofts, one way or another.
You must have missed some of the four-legged friends that you'd made because you regularly walked Cindy and Buttons.
I did. Those were for appeals for guide dogs for the blind, which the BBC and Blue Peter in particular had been very supportive of. And I mean, they got tremendous response. People collected so many milk bottle tops, it could have sunk the Titanic, I think. And we were able to provide quite a lot of support for guide dogs for the blind. So that was a good thing as well. But I had my own dogs. When I met my second wife, she had Pekingese. Her mother had bred them. And so we had a dog when we got together, and gradually we expanded that. We then had 2 dogs and then 3 dogs. And then at some point, at the most, we had 13 at one point because we happened to breed a litter of 7. Now we're down to just 3.
You and Kate, your second wife, have lived in Suffolk for many years, where you joined the board of the Wolsey Theatre in Ipswich. And one of the first productions you were involved in was Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. It's a pretty gruesome musical. What do you like about it?
I was lucky enough to go with Kate to the first performance in the West End in Drury Lane. I was knocked out. Sondheim is, sadly was, a genius, absolute genius, a wonderful, wonderful composer, brilliant lyricist, so clever with his words. And Sweeney Todd really is an absolute gem. And the main song which opens the show, Attend the Tale of Sweeney Todd, what a great chorus piece it is.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd. He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod, did Sweeney Todd. A demon barber of Fleet Street.
He kept a shop in London town, of fancy clients and good renown. And what if none of their souls were saved? They went to their maker impeccably shaved. By Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
When we had the first night in Ipswich, at the interval, a woman sitting behind me, I heard her say, "Well, I've never seen anything as disgusting as that." I thought, "What the hell did you think it was going to be like? Do you not know the story?" It is, musically, I think it's absolutely incredible.
Attend the Tale of Sweeney Todd, the opening number of Stephen Sondheim's 1979 musical Sweeney Todd, performed by the original Broadway cast. Peter Purvis, as well as acting, presenting, directing, you've been involved in making corporate promotional videos, training young presenters at BBC Elstree and at the London Academy of Radio, Film and Television. What advice do you give budding presenters? How much is success as a presenter due to talent or luck or a combination thereof?
The big word is luck. I do think you've got to be able to do the job. Beyond that, it's luck. Right place, right time, just be fortunate. I've been very lucky three times in my career, and that's probably all I deserved, but that's it. And I put all of my career, both the good and the bad, to luck.
Well, now at 86, you're still involved in the world of Doctor Who, recording new audio dramas, and 2 years ago, a television appearance of Stephen Taylor reunited you with Vicky, played by Maureen O'Brien, in a special scene to mark the programme's 60th anniversary. You can find it on the BBC iPlayer. Last year, you toured in a version of A Christmas Carol with former Doctor Who star Colin Baker. So the acting's not really gone away, has it?
Nor will it ever, I don't think. Christmas Carol is a great show. You know, we do it like a radio play. We're on stage. There are four microphones across the front. We've got the stage manager's desk at the side with all the sound effect equipment. I'm playing Charles Dickens. I'm the narrator of the piece. And Colin is a brilliant Scrooge.
Asked in an interview earlier this year for the Doctor Who magazine whether you had any regrets, you said very honestly and surprisingly, deep down, I wish I'd never done Blue Peter. I wish I'd been more successful as an actor. Do you still feel that?
Yes, but in that, I'm not denigrating Blue Peter in any way. It's just that that stopped. My acting career actually had stopped. I was in a very parlous position when Blue Peter came along and virtually bailed me out. They didn't know they were doing that at all. And it changed the direction of my career. I was still performing, but what I really wanted to do was act. And luckily, the Big Finish work that you were talking about, the audio things. I've done about 36, 37 of those, and it's absolutely fabulous. It's lovely to act again, and I enjoy it. I love it.
For your final music, Peter, you're going to go home to Suffolk, aren't you?
I am indeed. It's from Benjamin Britten. I have to have something by Britten, particularly something that reflects where he lived in Snape and Aldborough. The sea interlude from Peter Grimes. Well, you're on Aldborough Beach. You're there. It's how that feels, how that is, how that... You can almost say you smell it when you hear it. It's just glorious.
Let's hear Moonlight from the four sea interludes from Peter Grimes. And so it only remains for me to say, Peter Purvis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moonlight, the third of Benjamin Britten's Sea Interludes from Peter Grimes, performed by the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Richard Hickox. It was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on today's Private Passions, the television presenter Peter Purvis. The programme was produced by Graham Rogers. Next week, Michael's guest will be the actor Paul Chahidi.
BBC Radio 3, the home of live classical music.
Experience Bizet's operatic masterpiece, Carmen, from the New York Met. An epic story of jealousy and tragedy as Carmen's irresistible allure drives the soldier Don Jose to destruction.
Join me, Deborah Lou Harder, from the Metropolitan Opera House, New York, for Opera on Three. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Good afternoon, Emily Jeffrey here with you on BBC Radio 3. Let me tell you what's coming up a little later this afternoon. We're in York for Choral Evensong at 3. Then at 4 o'clock, Alan Shipton is here with another selection of your jazz record requests, and that's followed by the early music show with Hannah French at 5. And then at 6 this evening, Georgia Man brings us Words and Music, marking 50 years since the death of the crime writer Agatha Christie. But now, at 1:30, it's time now to join Sarah Moore-Peach on a journey to Brooks' celebrated first violin concerto, which stops along the way for J.S. Bach, the great jazz violinist Stefan Grappelli, and some musical swindlers.
This is Music Map on Radio 3. Welcome to an hour and a half long listening journey, which will lead us eventually to this, Max Bruch's Violin Concerto. As we do on this show every week, we'll be exercising our musical muscles along the way, listening in to a whole variety of other sounds that are in some way connected to our destination. And we're going to begin today by plotting that destination in the broader landscape of the genre, the Violin Concerto, which emerged in the early 18th century.